Hey you guys, time once again for a Flickers of Fear book review. And on this installment, we're going to be talking about probably one of the most infamous, notorious horror novels of the past, the past few decades, I guess, ever since it came out. It originally came out in 1989. And if you know anything about horror fiction, and, you know, if you've seen any people's lists of, like, most disturbing books ever written, and things of that nature, pretty much this is on every one of them that I've seen. And I will say rightfully so. This is The Girl Next Door by Jack Ketchum. Now, as I said, this originally came out in 1989. And I will say this is, like, I talked about this on my TBR because this is a book that I've read at least once. I might have read it twice in the past, and I really wanted to do a reread of it, mostly because it's so iconic and it's so, you know, it's one that a lot of people are just kind of like, you know, it, like I said, it's a very, very disturbing and it comes up on a lot of people's lists. So I definitely wanted to discuss it. That said, if you haven't read it, I'm kind of like, I'm reluctant to recommend it necessarily because even though I think it's a brilliant book, it's brilliantly written, it really makes you, I mean, if horror is meant to make you feel disturbed and disgusted and just like questioning the fucking, like, what the fuck are humans even about? It's like, then this book succeeds probably better than any other book I've ever read. But I will say that this is so fucked up that you can't unread it. So if you're somebody that's gonna be, that knows that they're gonna be really upset by the shit that happens in this, because it's very, very, it's not exploitative, but he doesn't really shy away from describing some pretty horrible shit that happens. So if that's gonna bother you, I would recommend not reading it because it's gonna stay with you like forever. And I've watched like some other people's reviews of this too. And like a lot of people were like, you know, I felt like I had to read it at least once, but a lot of people are like, yeah, I'm never gonna read that ever again. So I don't know if there's something the matter with me that I've read it like three times now, but there's something about it that it's like, even though it will just make you angry and depressed and just, you know, what the fuck, like it will just make you weep for humanity. You know, it's one of those kind of books, so it's not a fun experience. So like I said, that's like, I can't really recommend it across the board, even though I think it's a brilliant book. And I think that if you know what you're getting into and you think that you, I'm just, this is gonna sound douchey, but it's like, if you think that you can handle it, and like I said, no shame if you can't, because it's like I read this and I'm almost sorry I read it, but in some ways I'm kind of not, because if you didn't know, this is, it's a fictional novel, but it's loosely based on a real case that happened. And the real case is, if anything, even worse than the horrific shit that happened in the book. So in a way, I like that he fictionalized it, not a lot, but to an extent that you could a little bit sort of, I don't know if I'd say distance yourself from the actual story, but because this is something that actually happened to somebody, to a child, it has a lot to say about, you know, not just the monstrosity of like what monsters humans can be, even humans that are supposedly normal, you know, and how like one person's, you know, savagery can infect others. So there's that element to it too, but it also kind of goes into people who stand by and do nothing, even though they could do something. And it also kind of goes into what was going on in the United States in the 1950s, like with all the kind of authoritarian, repressive type of shit, and like how children were treated, you know, how they were kind of just supposed to be not so much seen and not heard, but, you know, they were under the absolute authority of adults. And I feel like child abuse, spousal abuse, things like that weren't things that were really talked about to a great extent. And I think that at the time it was kind of like, you know, it wasn't that unusual, you know, for kids to get smacked around or for, you know, wives to get smacked around. So the fact that abuse this horrific could take place just under everyone's noses, essentially, with a lot of people, you know, a lot of kids in the neighborhood participating, just kind of goes to show how, you know, up to a point, it was kind of like an accepted thing that happened. So no one really thought that much about it. And it seemed, it's really sad because it seemed like at some point someone could have intervened and no one really did. And then by the time someone intervened, it was too late. So as I said, this originally came out in 1989. It's based on the real case of Sylvia Likens, the murder of Sylvia Likens, which has a Wikipedia page. And like I said, if you really want to ruin your day, you can go and read that, and it's fucking horrifying. So the real case, Sylvia Likens was a 16-year-old girl, and she and her younger sister, whose name was Jenny, were taken in by, I guess, a friend of their parents. Their parents were carnival workers, so they were gone, like, you know, several months out of the year. And they knew this woman, I believe her name was Gertrude Banicheski, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. She offered for money to look after them for a few months. I believe it was from, like, August to November, something like that, while the parents were away, like, at work. Now, what ended up happening was that, I guess, after a month or two, the maintenance checks stopped coming. Gertrude got pissed off about it and decided, for whatever reason, that she was going to start essentially torturing Sylvia and, to a lesser extent, her sister. And she also got all of her children and several of the neighborhood kids involved in the torture. It was like a fucked up Lord of the Flies situation, but in some ways even worse, because in Lord of the Flies, you know, these kids started acting like savages because there were no adults around to stop them. Whereas in this case, which Jack Ketchum also goes into in this fictionalized version, was that in this way you had an adult, an authority figure that was seemingly making this okay, which probably went a long way toward why all these kids sort of went along with it and thought that there wasn't really anything the matter with it. Even after they got caught, you know, even when they were in court and things like that, they really didn't seem to see the issue, or they didn't really seem to feel that bad about it. So it's, I mean, the real story is a horrifying, horrifying story. This one is fictionalized, but it's loosely based on the real thing. So in the novel is actually told in the first person, and it's told from the point of view of a guy named David. Now, at the beginning of the book, he's kind of just talking about how he's been, like, financially successful in life, but, you know, he's on his third marriage now, and he's having, like, all these kind of other, like, emotional problems and things like that. And at which point, he decides that he's going to write down something that happened to him back in 1958 when he was 12 years old, just to kind of like purge it out of, I guess, somehow, because he wants everybody to know. So I think it's interesting because even though the real case took place, you know, the Sylvia Likens murder, that actually took place in Indiana in 1965, Jack Ketchum actually throws this back a few years, back to the 50s, and he says, there's kind of a long sort of author's note in the back of this particular edition where he's talking about, you know, why he did that. And like, you know, he kind of talks about how he came to the story and things. And he says that, you know, I wanted to set it at a time like when I was around this age. And he doesn't say it outright, but like I said, it's kind of implicit. And it's interesting that he set it back in the 50s instead of the mid 60s because of the, you know, the inherent sort of authoritarian, like I said, sort of thing where, you know, kids just, they did what adults said. That was just what you did back then. And so that kind of like feeds into this story and like what he wanted to say about this character. So the character of David, we go back and he's recalling 1958 when he was 12 years old. Now, he lives on this dead-end street. His parents are sort of, they don't go a lot into his parents or, you know, their relationship, but you can tell it's very distant, it's very broken. The dad has had a lot of affairs, and, you know, there's some maybe implied, like maybe a little bit of spousal abuse in there too. But David doesn't really, he doesn't really feel that great an attachment to them. But there's kind of a thing, and I think the beginning of the book, I mean, it takes a while before the actual, like, horrific shit starts happening. But I like that it's this kind of long buildup. It's almost kind of, I've seen it kind of compared to, like, a Stephen King type story, like Stand By Me, you know, or The Body, as the story is originally called. Like, that kind of thing where it's, you know, it's the 1950s. It's the idyllic American middle class sort of neighborhood. It's this dead end street. All the kids on the street are, you know, roughly the same age. They all kind of know each other. They all hang out together. You know, they're all listening to Elvis records. They're all doing this. And I think he got, I mean, since this was also the same era that he grew up, that Jack Ketchum grew up in. So he seems to have a real handle on, you know, what was going on at the time, what kids were like at the time, you know, what the pop culture was like at the time. So I think that really lends this just such a great sense of authenticity, which in turn sort of feeds into like the tragedy of what ends up happening. So he lives in this house. Next door is a single mother named Ruth Chandler and her three sons. Now, in real life, Gertrude had, I believe, 7 children, and they weren't all boys. Some of them were girls as well, and the girls also participated in the torture. But in this one, it's all boys. So Ruth, I guess, like, back in the, even though she was a single mom and people kind of looked askance, like, even David's parents are just kind of like, you know, they're civil to her, but they don't really want to associate, because she'd apparently been married a few times, like her husband had taken off on her and various other things, and she's kind of bitter about it. But in a lot of ways, David hangs out at her house a lot with the sons. I mean, he's friends with the older sons, because the mom is very permissive in the sense that she just lets the kids hang out over there. You know, you can come in, you don't have to knock or anything like that. She lets them smoke cigarettes. She, you know, sneaks them a beer every now and then. She lets them do things, you know, the neighborhood kids do things that their parents wouldn't necessarily be happy about them doing. So a lot of them like to hang out over there. And David even says near the beginning that he's like, you know, when he was 12 years old, he thought she was, I don't know if she necessarily said she was cool, but it's like, you know, he liked to hang out over there because he felt like he could be himself at her house in a way that he couldn't around his parents. So shortly after, you know, this whole kind of establishing scene, you have the arrival of a 14-year-old girl named Meg and her sister, whose name is Susan. Now, like I said, in real life, the two sisters, their parents were still alive, but the parents were working and they just like left them with a family friend, essentially. In the book, Meg and Susan's parents are killed in a car accident in which both sisters are wounded, although Meg only has some scars on her arms. Susan is pretty much, she can walk, but only with crutches. And she has braces on her legs. So yeah, so she was pretty messed up in the accident. And as I said, both of their parents were killed, at which point they are sent to live with Ruth Chandler, who is sort of like an aunt or like a distant relative. So she is kind of like related to them. So I guess like the state puts, you know, puts the sisters in the care of Ruth because she's the only living relative of the parents. So David first meets Meg in sort of this idyllic, you know, situation where he's out at this brook where they all used to play and he's catching crayfish or whatever. And she comes and she's a couple years older. She's 14, he's 12. But, you know, she's really good at catching crayfish and he's impressed and he talks about how pretty she is. So it's almost kind of like they're setting it up at first. Like Meg is like his first crush, I guess. Like he thinks she's really pretty and he thinks she's really cool. And then he finds out that it's like she's just moved in with Ruth and the boys next door. And so he's very excited about that because he's like, oh, I'll be seeing her all the time. And, you know, we can all hang out together and it'll be really awesome. So for a time, it kind of goes like that. And there's like some scenes near the beginning, like I said, which are really good because knowing how this story goes, it's like the more that you get these little scenes of them just like kind of sweet, like he takes her on the Ferris wheel at the carnival and they're kind of like talking and, you know, just like sweet scenes like that. This kind of like knowing how the story goes, it just makes it all the more heartbreaking because you just know that this is like the last time that this girl is gonna be happy. And it's just, I don't know. This book, like I said, this is a soul-crushing book, okay? So I'm just telling you that right now. And I know that some people would not want to read this, and I do not blame them at all. Because like I said, if you read this and then you know that it's based on a real case, it's just gonna bum you out. It's just gonna make you feel like, And I know that some people don't want to read something that makes them feel like that. And like I said, I don't blame them whatsoever. But I will say that I think the reason that I've read this book two or three times now at this point is just because, yes, it's soul crushing, but it's also very powerful, you know, and I kind of like this exploration of this moral gray area, so particularly in the character of David, who, as I said, sort of, as, you know, things go on in the book, like, he knows what's happening, but he doesn't really do anything. And having things from his point of view is really interesting because you can kind of like, well, like, what's going on in his head and stuff like that. And you're like, well, you know, if I was a kid during this time period, what would I have done? Would I have told somebody? Would I have told a cop? Would I have told my parents? You know, would anything have happened? And in a way, like, you can kind of feel sorry for him because, as I said, in that cultural context, you know, even if he had told, you know, how helpful would it have been? Because, you know, there were some things that transpire in the book where people did, like, tell a cop or something like that, but nothing really got done because they're just kind of like, oh, you know, she probably had it coming or something like that. Because, like I said, people smacked kids around back then. And no one really thought that much about it. So everyone probably just thought she was making a big deal out of nothing. But I like the exploration in this of his complicity and his guilt about standing by, even though David doesn't participate in the abuse directly. He does watch it, and he does admit that sometimes he felt, you know, aroused by it or excited by the prospect that, you know, this is allowed now. Even though initially he had had a crush on her and actually liked her as a person and was, like, sympathetic, empathetic even. But then as time goes on, it's almost kind of like he has these little bursts of resentment. Maybe she did do something to deserve this. Maybe, you know, it can't be wrong. There's an adult is perpetrating it. You know, an adult that I like is perpetrating it. So it can't be wrong. She must have done something to bring it on. So like I said, this is like some pretty dark, it's very grim, it's very heavy, you know, but it does explore these kind of questions of, you know, if you see something like this going on, you know, what is your responsibility to, like, try to stop it? And he doesn't try to stop it, not really, like, until the end. So as it goes on, like I said, at first, Ruth decides that she doesn't particularly like Meg. Now, they don't really go into, because you're not seeing this from the character of Ruth's point of view, but you do kind of get a sense that Ruth is kind of like, she seems to me like a self-hating woman. Like, I guess because maybe, and like I said, this is an implication and this may not have been Jack Ketchum's intent, but I kind of feel like maybe in her upbringing, she was kind of taught a particular thing about women because she says things about other women. Oh, women are just sluts. You know, that's all they're good for is just to get, you know, fucked over and used and then left behind. And so I kind of feel like the implication being that maybe she was taught that and maybe her life experiences have sort of solidified that for her. So it's almost kind of like she's lashing out at other women, and particularly at Meg, because Meg seems like a little pretty girl who's kind of on the cusp of womanhood. So Ruth maybe sees her as not threatening necessarily, but sees her as sort of emblematic of everything that she hates and everything that she couldn't have, because now she's older, she's been saddled with three kids, so she says, you know, she's had two or three husbands that have left her, she's been fucked over, like, pretty much her whole life, and so she resents Meg because Meg represents, you know, burgeoning womanhood or someone who still has her whole entire life ahead of her, and so she decides that she's going to punish her that way. There's also, it's not even an implication, it's actually said outright that Ruth gets a sexual charge out of torturing Meg, and also it comes out later that she's also sexually abusing Susan, the, you know, the little crippled girl. So that comes out as well. Even though Susan doesn't get as much abuse, she still gets a lot of abuse as well. So there's that. And she's also used as a bargaining chip for, you know, if Meg won't do what Ruth or the other kids want her to do, then she'll say, oh, well, we're going to take it out on Susan, and Susan can't run away because she can hardly walk. So as I said, it kind of goes to the point where at first it's just kind of like teasing, or, you know, but very mean-spirited teasing toward Meg, where it's like, you know, calling her a slut, you know, saying she's fat, that type of stuff, you know, and then like kind of doing things like tickling her and then like grabbing her boob or like, you know, shit like that, which, like I said, it's bad, but at first it doesn't really seem like anything egregious, at least, you know, considering how far it gets later. Now, as it goes on, the abuse kind of gets worse and worse. And as I said, at some point, Meg does actually report it to a cop, but the cop doesn't really do much of anything about it. Thinking, like I said, that it's a family matter. Ruth is your mom now, and I'm sure, you know, you are maybe a troublemaker and you deserved to get smacked or whatever. You know, she's trying to keep you in line. So it was that kind of thing. So they didn't really investigate it to any great degree. So as time goes on, it just gets worse and worse until they essentially, Ruth and her sons, chain Meg in the basement and won't let her come up. You know, the various forms of torture, and as I said, this is based on a true story, and a lot of, he did change some things, but not that much. So most of the stuff that happens to Meg in this book actually also happened to Sylvia Likens in real life. So that's cheerful, I'm sure. At first, she's just kind of roped to the ceiling, and they kind of have her standing on books, and then they'll take the books away. So it's like, you know, the strain and everything. They won't really give her any water. They won't really give her any food. You know, she gets very dehydrated. They won't let her take a bath. And then they start doing things more like sexual type things where they, you know, they'll cut her clothes off. They start cutting her. They start burning her with cigarettes. At one point, they feed her dog shit. It's just this kind of, and like I said, that actually did happen. You know, they piss on her face. It's just like all these horrible, horrible things. And then like, as it goes on, it really gets into some horrifying, which I don't really want to get too much into, but you know, bodily mutilation, rape, other things of that nature. And it's not just Ruth at this point kind of participating, it's also her three sons, and it's also some of the neighborhood kids, because now it's become sort of like, it almost becomes sort of like a thing where, you know, oh, let's all go over to the Chandler house and go down to the basement and just do whatever we want to this girl that they have chained there, because, like I said, because an adult is supervising it, even though she's clearly insane, that gives them license to pretty much do whatever they want to her. You know, at this point, she's just like a thing to them, like a plaything. Now, I will note too that even before Meg gets there, like even before Meg moves to that, to the house, neighborhood kids did actually have something that they called the game, where they would, essentially it just started out as sort of like a tag sort of game, but you'd get to the end and if you got captured, they would like tie you to a tree. And then once the girl started playing, they would tie the girl to a tree. They'd take her clothes off. They would like ask her like all these, you know, creepy questions. They would touch her in sexual ways and stuff. But that was with the girl's sort of consent, like that, like they were kind of all, so there was kind of like a precedent, because as it goes on, when they had Meg down in the basement, you know, the Chandler boys actually told their mom about this, hey, we play this game out in the woods with some of the girls, and you know, we like to do it to each other, so it's like, let's do this to her, because you know, she's just this thing that we can like use however they want to use her. So yeah, so like I said, you can probably imagine like where this is going. The outcome of the book is kind of the same in the sense of what happens to Meg, in the sense of what happens to Susan, you know, the sisters. But the outcome of the book is actually a little bit more satisfying than what happened in real life. I will say that. I don't really want to spoil it. So like I said, if you really, really don't want to read about horrific, horrific child abuse portrayed in a very realistic and quite graphic way, you know, children doing other abuse on other children while adults are like supervising or looking on and also participating, if that does not sound like something that you want to read, then please do not read this, because it's one of those books that will definitely stick with you for a very long time and will make you kind of question your own, I don't know, like, question your own, like, what would you have done if you were in David's situation? Because, like I said, David, for a long time, even though he knows what's going on over there, and even though he never, as I said, directly participates in the abuse, because he still, to a small extent, still sees her as a person, but he does kind of wrestle with the fact that he was excited by it, and that he also kind of is still wrestling with the fact that all of this guilt that he had for not really doing anything. And really, he did do something in the end, but by that time, it was kind of too late. And the damage had already been done. And, you know, and like I said, you can question how much, you know, how effective would him intervening have been. I mean, he was only a 12-year-old kid, but he does kind of try to be the hero at the end, and he does kind of do some things, but it's, you know, as I said, it's too little too late. But just the fact that he wasn't able to help her, and that he in some ways was complicit in what happened to her by not telling anyone about it, you know, is kind of like fucking him up. So that to me was one of the most powerful things about this story, is that, and that's why I like that he wrote it from the point of view of a neighbor who was there, who wasn't participating, but he was watching it and didn't take any responsibility for it, and was almost kind of like trying to justify, like, oh, it's okay because I didn't hurt her, and no one would have listened to me anyway. I was just a little kid, you know. So he kept coming up with all these excuses for why he didn't tell anybody. But in the end, he didn't tell anybody, and you know, it ended up pretty much as bad as it could end up. And he's never really gotten over it in the sense of the book. Now, they did actually make a movie adaptation of this, and I believe it was 2007. So the one that's 2007, I think Blanche Baker was in it. That the movie's pretty good. It sticks pretty close to the book. It's obviously, there was some stuff that was in the book that they couldn't really show, but it's still a pretty faithful adaptation. And then they made a movie called An American Crime, which actually isn't based on the book, but is actually based on the real case. It's based on the Sylvia Likens case, which had Ellen, now Elliot Page, which I don't think I've seen it, but I've heard it was very good. I didn't mind the movie adaptation of the book, but like I said, it's not the same as reading it. And I think that it sort of like lessened its impact a little bit because, I mean, they had to have an older girl playing Meg, because in the book she's only 14, and obviously you don't really want to make a movie with a 14-year-old girl having all the shit happens to her and what happens in this book. So they had to have an actress that was older, that was like over 18. And it's pretty evident that she's over 18. I mean, I'm not saying she looks like way older or anything. She does still look young, but she's obviously like much older than the character is supposed to be. And I understand why they did that. There's really no way around it. I mean, obviously you don't want to see a real 14-year-old girl in that role, but I think it still lessened the impact somewhat. But the movie is still good, and still, I don't know if I want to say it's worth watching because it's also pretty heart-wrenching. The book is worse, I will say that, but the movie is pretty hard to watch also. And like I said, I've read some reviews of this, and some people said, look, I just watched the movie and there's no fucking way that I'm reading the book because the movie was fucking bad enough, which, like I said, and the book is worse. Now, I will say too that, I mean, I've read most of Jack Ketchum's other stuff. He sadly passed away a couple years back. I think it was in 2018. And all of his stuff is great. I mean, he is known as, much like Richard Layman, although I think Jack Ketchum is a better writer than Richard Layman just in general, but all his stuff is very graphic, you know, is very brutal. But that said, his writing is just so, there's something just really, really compelling about his writing style. It's very to the point. He doesn't, it's not flowery at all. It's not, and in this book in particular, I think that really goes a long way toward selling, not only like making this a book that you want to put down because it's so fucking horrible what's happening, but also you can't put it down because his writing is just so, you know, it's just so, so powerful. Just these kind of short sentences and just the way that he just lays everything out, like straightforwardly and everything like that, just makes it even more horrible because, you know, this is what happened and he's just like putting it in your face. So you can't really get away from it. You can't really like turn away from it. So I think in a way, like I said, I've read pretty much all of his books, I think. Off Season is also great, which is about cannibals. You know, it wasn't based on a true story. It's more like a regular horror. But his whole thing is he's fascinated by human monsters more than supernatural monsters. He wants to delve into, you know, the darkest side of the human psyche and sort of just bring it up and show it to you and say, this is what, you know, this is what your fellow humans are capable of given, you know, the situation at hand. And I think that can be the most disturbing kind of horror. So, I mean, easily, this is one of the most disturbing books I have ever read. And from looking at the reviews, most people agree that, I mean, if you are really not into disturbing real shit, because like I said, this is, it's fictionalized, but not that much. So if you really don't want to, like, you know, confront this fucking story about what happened to this poor fucking child and her sister too, to a slightly lesser extent, it's just, I mean, like I said, it's not a fun time. It's not an enjoyable book. That's why I'm saying that it's, like, really hard for me to recommend it to somebody. Cause I don't want to, like, recommend it to somebody and be like, thanks, I'm, like, fucking traumatized for life now. But if you're in the right, if you know what you're getting into and you just want to kind of read a thing about, you know, where you just go into the darkest fucking corners of human savagery and read about something like that and people's reaction to it, then I think it's actually a brilliant piece of writing. And it's actually one of my favorite books. I know that's a fucked up thing to say because this is a very fucked up book, but the violence in it, though, is not exploitative. It's not the same as, you know, watching, like, a fun, gory horror movie. It's like, you know, watching, you know, people's heads get chopped off and stuff like that. I mean, that's just, you know, that's, yes, that really happens and stuff like that. But in horror fiction, that's usually, like, fantasy. It's kind of, like, just, you know, it's fun. It's like a fantasy fulfillment type of thing. This one is a whole other, this book is a whole other kettle of fish. It's really not, it's not written, the violence is not written in there to titillate anyone. It's not put in there to excite anyone. It's put in there to disgust you at how horrible and how horrific and how savage humans can be. So that said, like I said, it's not a fun read. It's very grim, but I really do, it really is one of my favorite books of all time. And that's why I wanted to do a review of it, even though, you know, as I said, I just can't recommend it across the board because it's just a horrific book, but I love it in a weird way. But it's one that you really want to, like, space out if you're going to read it more than once. I would, like, put along, because it's really one that it kind of, like, wears you out emotionally. I will say that too. But yeah, so if you think, like I said, if you think that, like, you're not, it's not going to, like, fucking give you trauma for life, which, like I said, if you do think that, that's totally fine. I'm not saying anything. But yeah, this is Jack Ketchum, The Girl Next Door. This is the cover. I bought this one back in the early 2000s, I want to say. There was one that came out, I think the original paperback. I just wanted to mention this because I've seen another edition of this, which I think was, like, the older edition, because this one's not that old. But the original edition of this, which I think was from Warner Publications or whatever, it was kind of one of those 80s paperback originals where they had these really, like, cheesy ass covers. This one had a cover of a skeleton in a like a 50s cheerleader outfit, like with the saddle shoes and the pom-poms and everything, which I thought was, like, so fucking bizarre. Because if you saw that cover and then you read the book, you'd be like, what the fuck? The cover doesn't have anything to do with anything. And the cover just really kind of, like, I don't usually get offended by, like, cover art or anything, but that, I was just like, that totally, like, cheapened the whole fucking book. That looked like some kind of cheesy, you know, like some cheesy 80s slasher type of artwork, which it wouldn't bother me if it was that kind of book, but it's totally, totally not. So I don't know, like, whoever designed that cover, I don't know what the fuck they were thinking, but every time I see it, I'm just kind of like, I just shake my fucking head. I'm like, what the hell? Like, a fucking cheerleading skeleton. What the fuck does that have to do with, like, vicious and horrible child abuse that's based on a true crime? I have no idea. But I just, if anybody knows, like, what, like, who made that fucking executive decision, I'd really like to know, because what the hell, man, what were you smoking? I don't know. But anyway, yeah, so Jack Ketchum, The Girl Next Door. I would, like, honestly, I really love Jack Ketchum's work. Like I said, it's brutal, it's vicious. You know, if you're in the mood for it, if you know what to expect, then his writing is actually very powerful. So I would recommend it, you know, in that regard. But otherwise, you know, buyer beware, I guess I'm gonna say. But yeah, that'll do it for this Tomes of Terror, and I will see you guys on the next one. Bye.